Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top, Costco could provide huge boost to Apex. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Apex. The developers of a proposed Costco wholesale store on US 64 in Apex have moved one step closer to breaking ground in early 2014. While the project's site plan and design still need the town council's approval, it's on the November 19 council meeting agenda. The Apex Planning Board recommended approval of the plans at its November 12 meeting, says Apex Planning Director Diane Kinn. But if approved, the wholesaler will bring much more than discounted engagement rings and bulk packaged paper towels to Western Way County. The 149,500 square foot store would also create more than 150 new job positions and greatly boost Apex's general fund with additional property and sales tax revenue. Apex Town Manager Bruce Radford says his staff has not yet calculated how much additional revenue the Costco could bring in each year, but he does expect the store to become the town's largest electricity customer and one of its largest new water and sewer users. I think it's going to have a tremendous impact, he says. Costco already has two wholesale stores in the Triangle, one in Raleigh near the I-440 Beltline on Wake Forest Road, and another in North Durham off I-85, and it has long been rumored that Costco was looking for a third location in the affluent Cary area. South Carolina-based developer Columbia Development has agreed to finance and build a new road on the north side of the Nichols Plaza property to connect Laura Duncan Road with the Harris Teeter anchored shopping center next door. Columbia Development will also widen existing turn lanes and add turn lanes onto the heavily trafficked US 64. The town will split the $36,000 cost of adding turn lanes onto US 64 at Old Raleigh Road. I'd call that a very nominal kind of partnership, Radford says. All the rest is developer-funded. The Costco developers will use a brick facade for the warehouse exterior since town leaders didn't want a metal box, Radford says. And the retailer has agreed to use more subdued exterior lighting, which had been a concern of nearby residents. Bud Mann, a partner with Columbia Development, says he's still under a confidentiality agreement to not identify the anchor tenant at Nichols Plaza, but says they have tried to appease most of the neighbors' requests. Mann and his partners have a contract to purchase the 35-acre site in Apex from a group led by former NC State University agriculture professor Everett Nichols, Jr. The Nichols land had previously been a target for auto dealers wanting to build new dealerships, but Radford says town leaders had rejected those plans. The Apex land has a $2.4 million tax value with no buildings on it, according to county records. And when the Raleigh Costco opened in 2006, the building's property tax value was listed as $7 million. Plans for the Apex project showed a 149,500 square foot building for Costco, a Costco gas station, and nine outparcels for other future retail and service businesses. As of September 1, Costco had 71 million members and $105 billion in annual revenue. A typical store has between 150 and 200 employees. A research study published in 2011 by a former UNC Greensboro economist finds evidence that Costco can drive up grocery prices in the surrounding area when it opens a new store, especially in smaller towns. That compares to evidence of the opposite effect when a Walmart moves in and nearby grocery stores reduce their prices to compete. The Apex Costco could open in late 2014 or early 2015. And now taking up the rest of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is the cover story. The headline in bold white letters, Life After Prison, Confessions of an Accountant. And there's a large picture of a man who the story is about. And this article is written by Sugata Mukherjee. On January 15, 2010, Jay McLamb said goodbye to his kids and immediate family as his wife, Sonia, prepared the car for a three-hour-plus trip to Petersburg, Virginia, the site of a prison run by the U.S. Department of Justice. Inside the gates of the sprawling minimum-security campus Orders were barked at McLam as he was processed and directed through a full-body search before being escorted by guards to what would become his home for the next 15 months. Federal prisoner 25796-056 had been booked. While walking down the prison hallways, McLam could see his wife walking back to the car, crying. After serving his prison time, he faced an additional 6 months in a halfway house before being able to return to his home and family. That's the price McLam was ordered to pay for the felonious crime of cheating the federal government out of about $8 million. He decided to use the time to rehabilitate himself. McLam describes his 15 months of incarceration as a state where where the world seemed distant and the people were strangers. Still, he felt relieved. He knew his lies were behind him and he would have the chance, once out of prison, to reconstruct his life with Sonia and the kids. "You were in this hell, but you have to make the most of it," McLam, 47, says. "This wasn't club-fed." Today, McLam has a good job and lives in a small rented house near downtown Raleigh. He accepts speaking invitations, especially to college students, about how he went wrong and the lessons learned from his mistakes. But the road all the way back is a long one. The history. Born in Benson, east of Raleigh in Johnston County, the son of a farmer, McLam joined the Castleton Group in 2001, a Raleigh-based human relations outsourcing firm that contracted with businesses to manage their health insurance, retirement plans, workers' compensation, and other HR needs. According to federal authorities, McLam collected and withheld federal taxes from individual employers on behalf of employees and then falsified documents that were being filed with the Internal Revenue Service. More than $7 million in payroll taxes owed to the IRS went missing, and a large number of the approximately 3,500 workers who relied on Castleton were left without health insurance, their taxes unpaid, and their 401k retirement accounts frozen. McLam, during testimony at his trial, took all the blame and was sentenced to 2.5 years in federal prison, later reduced to 15 months. He was also slapped with a $7 million federal lien that likely will remain on his record for the rest of his life. He pays $100 per month to the government in restitution. That number could change based on his earnings. Castleton CEO and primary owner, Suzanne Clifton, filed for bankruptcy in 2009. About 2 years after the State Department of Insurance assessed Castleton as insolvent, which forced the company into liquidation, Clifton was never charged with criminal wrongdoing. But how could this happen? "I knew the company was in disarray from day one," McLam recalls. "I was inheriting an administrative mess. We had no money." Between 2001 and 2005, McLam got more and more entrenched at Castleton, even putting in $200,000 of his own money to keep the company afloat in exchange for a minority ownership stake. He and his boss, Clifton, attended Tony events around the Triangle, hobnobbing with the political and the executive classes at charity events. But then came the letter from the IRS in October 2007. The feds wanted to know why there was a discrepancy between the W-3s, summary of all W-2s issued by an employer, and Form 941s, an employer's quarterly federal tax return. McLam had decided to file different forms because he could not change the W-3s. If he did, the workers would know there was something wrong with their W-2s. The jig would have been up immediately. But when the IRS letter came, "I knew it was over," McLam says. All of this time, as the accounting fraud was going on, McLam did not steal any money for his personal gain, an assertion that was corroborated by federal authorities who could not find additional money in any of McLam's or his family's accounts. "To me, I wanted to make sure our clients' insurance premiums were paid," McLam says, "but we did not have enough money to pay those premiums and pay the taxes. I had to choose." Unlikely friends. Today, McLam speaks to local groups about the consequences of falsifying documents and urges accountants and accounting students at his alma mater, NC State University, not to succumb to the pressures of their jobs regardless of the intent. Still, for a long time and even now, McLam believes his crime was cloaked in good faith. And that may have led to a growing friendship between him and the person who put him behind bars, IRS investigator Scott Schiller. "I was taken by his remorse," Schiller says, "so I wrote to him in prison and told him there is life after prison." Schiller, with 33 years as a federal investigator, is well-versed in white-collar crimes and individuals who commit them. White-collar criminals could easily be your neighbor, he says. What was different about McLam, Schiller says, is that he is determined to change his life and wants all the guidance he can get from the right people. His crimes may have been a result of being overly ambitious, Schiller says. Schiller's letter proved to be influential, leading to McLam's decision to tell his story to the public as part of his What Not to Do as an Accountant in Business. It is unlikely McLam will be able to change the opinions of most of the 3,500-odd employees affected by his decision to manipulate the books. To many, he will always remain a criminal and can never be trusted. No question there were victims other than the federal government, Schiller concedes. McLam acknowledges that skepticism and adds, "People make mistakes. I made a big one." 5 years removed from the case, Schiller, now retired from the IRS, considers McLam a friend and is impressed by his resolve. "I often think about people I sent to jail," he says. A life partner. For McLam, much of his inner strength is coming from his wife, Sonia. They were high school sweethearts, and now they are charting the often choppy waters of a new life together. When the legal ordeal began, she vociferously defended her family when online chats about Castleton, Clifton, and McLam were lighting up message boards. Their kids, aged 14, 12, and 7 at the time, were out of bounds, she told numerous posters. Sonia McLam knew nothing of her husband's criminal actions until the day of the IRS letter in 2007. "That night, I looked at his face and knew something was terribly wrong," she says. As she grappled with her husband's actions and the upcoming legal consequences, she started thinking of the family. "If he was dishonest about that, what else could he be dishonest about?" she says of the time. But a trip to McLam's criminal attorney, Joe Cheshire, put to rest the immediate emotional issues. After that meeting, "We knew we will be together and the family will be intact," she says. McLam was about to find out that a return to his wife and his family was the prospect that he would be clinging to for a long time. The lawyer's take. Raleigh criminal attorney Cheshire says McLam was in denial at the start of his legal ordeal. And that's not unusual for people with education. Quite often they think they did not commit a crime or they would spend time justifying that what they did was okay. Slapping his hand on the desk as hard as he could, Cheshire once told McLam he could be looking at more than 35 years in prison. That got his attention, Cheshire says. Cheshire, who has represented prominent individuals in highly publicized cases, says white-collar criminals are generally stunned when they hear the true risks of decision-making in the gray area. You can go from very, very light gray to very, very dark gray in accounting, Cheshire says, referring to the thousands of federal and state accounting laws, many of which are up for interpretation. Jay is going to turn this around into something that will benefit society, Cheshire says. If more of these people have these conversations, group talks, it may stop other people from destroying themselves. Fast forward. McLam's process of starting anew was jump-started just days after he left prison in late 2011 when he landed a job with the Carly C's IGA grocery chain in Dunn, thanks to Mac McLam, a distant relative. "When I offered him the job, I really did not know he was a relative," recalls McLam, Carly C's CEO. "Through a friend, I had been following Jay's case and felt that he would need help after he was out of prison." Because of his decision to hire Jay McLam as the CFO of a $100 million company, Carly C's lost its largest banker soon afterward, when bank officials said they could not do business with a company whose CFO had been convicted of tax evasion. That hardly bothered Mac McLam. "We were not concerned about what things look like," says the 48-year-old McLam, whose dad started the Carly C's chain of stores more than 5 decades ago. "Jay was very capable, and he really is in a sweet spot right now," McLam says, referring to the fact that his CFO now understands the business very well. While many wondered why Jay McLam got such a big break right after his incarceration ended, to Mac McLam it was personal. A person who fought severe drug addiction some 20 years ago, Mac McLam thanks an inner circle of friends and family for getting him through those terrible months. "I know what it's like when you're that down," says Mac McLam. In fact, he believes the change in Jay McLam's view of life while in prison is what made him fit with the Carly C's culture. "Truth is, his spirited culture would not have fit our culture before he went to prison," says the CEO. From his nondescript office in Dunn, Jay McLam seems open, honest, and reflective. The weight of the guilt and shame he carried for almost a decade is off his shoulders. He is comfortable in his own skin, and along with his wife, is tackling the economic issues that come with a tax lien on an individual's record. Even leasing a car with this lien against us is very tough, Sonia McLam says. But her husband is quick to add that the family is adjusting to living without any available credit. McLam's court-imposed probationary period ends in April, and at that time he will have served his federal sentencing obligations. These days, McLam often brings a can of tuna and a sleeve of stamps with him when he speaks to groups. On a sunny fall day at NCSU just a few weeks ago, talking to some accounting students in Professor Mark Beasley's class, McLam raised the tuna and the stamps above his head and proclaimed, "You need this when you are in prison. This is prison currency." "I knew everything I was doing was wrong. I was living a lie," McLam told those young students. That lie is now long past him. Now he wants to make the best of the second chance he got to start all over again. And now we turn to the biz section, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings. The first article that starts it off, dinner, good company, and local art. Biz always looks forward to the annual Guess Who's Coming to Dinner event organized by the United Arts Council of Raleigh and Wake County, and this year was no different in terms of mission and impact. About 19 area homes hosted local artists to showcase their talents in front of a handful of guests who paid $175 each to attend the dinners between November 7 and November 9. The event is a fundraiser for the UAC's Artists in the Schools program. Officials said the dinner fundraiser usually brings in about $90,000 each year and costs about $30,000 to put together. Biz was at Jody and Tony Tata's house along with several local executives, including Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce President Harvey Schmidt, Raleigh City Councilwoman Marianne Baldwin, and CEPI Engineering founder CEPI Asefnia. Jean-Claude Bemis, a talented local artist and 2013 Piedmont Laureus designee, was on hand to talk about the importance of arts in our schools. Biz is convinced it was a memorable evening for many. Trees Across Raleigh plants 65 trees at SPCA. Dozens of volunteers of all ages turned out for the recent Trees Across Raleigh planting at the Raleigh SPCA. 65 10-gallon trees donated by Taylor's Nursery in Raleigh were planted around the SPCA property. Raleigh photographer and TAR volunteer Simon Griffiths of Simon Griffiths Photography found himself on the other side of the lens, wielding not a camera, but a pickaxe. Veterans Day honors at Wake Med. Wake Med Health and Hospitals was one of many Triangle organizations to honor veterans on Monday. Interim CEO Rear Admiral Donald Ginzig brought unique perspective to the staff, which has more than 270 who have served or are serving in the United States Armed Forces. It takes a remarkable person to volunteer to serve in the armed forces. They must be able to lead and to follow. They must be ready to respond at a moment's notice, he said. We owe each of them a debt of gratitude. Ginzig retired from the Navy just a few weeks before assuming the interim CEO role. Oprah recommends triangle-based gifts. As Biz was sifting through Oprah Winfrey's latest list of favorite things, looking for the perfect Christmas gift, it noticed a few triangle connections. One item on the list was a set of baby bibs by Durham-based Burt's Bees, and each favorite thing comes complete with a description of why it made the list, all attributable to Oprah herself. Of the Burt's Bees bibs, Oprah writes on her website, "Here's what the well-dressed baby is wearing this season." Also among Oprah's favorite things are champagne glasses made by Hillsborough's own Vitri, an Italian dinnerware and home decor company. "Champagne gets even more festive when sipped from these dishwasher-safe flutes," Oprah states on Oprah.com. From high school band to global trainer, Biz recently caught up with Broughton High classmate Randy Russell, one of the first 100 employees at Raleigh open source company Red Hat. Russell started with the company back when it was at Research Triangle Park, then moved to Centennial Campus, then to Red Hat Tower downtown, where he provided Biz a tour. "At first I wasn't sure about the move, but downtown Raleigh isn't what it was when we were in high school," Russell said. There are great bars and restaurants and lots of things going on down here. Russell, whom Biz remembers as a crackerjack alto saxophone player in the Broughton Band, is Red Hat's Global Director of Certification. Around the World in Several Tasty Courses. At a recent invitation-only dinner menu tasting event at Plate's Neighborhood Kitchen on Glenwood Avenue in downtown Raleigh, the fuss was all about globally inspired dishes with a variety of flavors. Pan-roasted flounder with braised butter beans, gnocchi with oyster mushrooms and a lemon-thyme butter sauce, duck spring rolls, five-spice short ribs, wines, and local beers. Owner Chef Steve Day personally served every dessert, including chocolate chess pie, UK-style sticky toffee pudding, and ginger cookies. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Cameron Snipes, and Dawn Curry. And now we return to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Small Durham Firm Gains Big Partner, and this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Durham. Durham textile startup Pure Thread Technologies has a new and unlikely partner, film giant Eastman Kodak. Kodak, based in Rochester, New York, and known for its printers and camera film, has been quietly shifting its focus toward what was once a side project, antimicrobials, particularly in the packaging space. And it's banking on strategic partnerships for its turnaround after a 2012 bankruptcy filing. PurThread, which already develops bacterial-resistant curtains for hospitals, saw the potential for a collaboration reaching out to Eastman Kodak. Kodak's microbial history spans decades, explains Thomas McHugh, its director of materials and manufacturing. It was really around film preservation of photographic materials, he explains. The gelatin is a nice soup for bugs to live in, so we've always been employing biocide-like materials. This particular antimicrobial collaboration deals with silver chemistry, he explains, which has also been used to prevent discoloration. That's what attracted PurThread to us, he says. PurThread will be manufacturing the fiber, yarn, and fabric for the arrangement, says Lisa Grimes, PurThread CEO. Lab work and research will take place in Durham. Neither company is releasing the financial results of the deal, but Grimes does say it's a licensing agreement. Kodak just returned to the New York Stock Exchange, trading under the symbol KODK, starting November 1, a change that Antonio Perez, CEO, says reflects that we are a new company that is focused on business-to-business products and services. The numbers seem to reflect a slimmed-down company. Kodak ended its last quarter this month with $839 million in cash and debt of $679 million. Compare that to the end of 2012, with debts of $1.4 billion. PurThread, which has 8 employees at its new Durham headquarters, has raised more than $3 million in venture financing, according to securities filings. And now we turn to a Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we have Todd Cohen's column, which is headlined, Child Care Services Works to Boost Early Education Nutrition. Every weekday at kitchens in Durham and Chapel Hill, breakfast, lunch, and snacks are prepared for 900 children at 24 child care centers in Durham and Orange counties. At Meredith College in Raleigh, 25 infant toddler teachers are enrolled in a course to improve their teaching. And in Beaufort, Chauwin, Hertford, and Hyde counties in eastern North Carolina, at-risk kids from birth to age 2 are enrolled in a pilot program modeled on the state's pre-kindergarten program. All those efforts are the work of a Child Care Services Association, a Chapel Hill nonprofit created through the 1999 merger of agencies in Chapel Hill and Durham that both were formed in 1974 with United Way funding to improve early childhood education. Operating with an annual budget of $30 million and a staff of more than 100 people, Child Care Services helps parents find child care programs and operates scholarship and wage supplement programs for child care professionals throughout North Carolina and in other states. These programs have helped professionals improve their skills and stay in their jobs longer. The agency also provides a range of services in the Triangle and throughout the state and the U.S. Child Care Services, which receives the bulk of its funds in the form of federal grants through the state, as well as funds from local partnerships for children that operate Smart Start early childhood programs, has helped parents of more than 100,000 children in the Triangle find quality child care that fits the parents' needs to attend school or go to work, says Anna Carter, the association's president. It's TEACH, T-E-A-C-H, Early Childhood Scholarships, piloted in 1990, helps 3,500 North Carolina early care and education teachers a year take classes at community colleges and four-year colleges and universities. Child Care Resources has licensed that program to groups in 24 other states and recently received a $1 million grant from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation to do more innovative work in some of those states. A total of 120,000 early care and education teachers have received scholarships. Salary supplements through the agency's Child Care Wages Program, launched in 1994 in Orange County, boost the compensation for about 4,600 early care and education teachers and administrators throughout the state each year. The supplement has helped reduce the turnover rate among the state's estimated 30,000 early childhood teachers and administrators from 19% to 14%, Carter says. Child Care Services, which this year has served almost 1 million meals to children in Orange and Durham counties, hopes to expand its nutrition program to Wake County. It also provides child care scholarships for parents in Durham County, technical assistance in Durham, Orange, and Wake counties to help child care programs improve their services, and professional development workshops and courses in the Triangle for child care directors, teachers, and home providers. There's not a silver bullet, Carter says, for the variety of resources and supports that are needed to make sure children get that quality they need to succeed later in life. And in nonprofit news, MetLife Incorporated employees gleaned 5,800 pounds of sweet potatoes on November 9 for local food banks as part of the Gleaning America's Fields program. The Society of St. Andrews takes what would be wasted crops and provides it to local food banks in Wake Forest, Durham, East Wake, and Knightdale. MetLife added a $5,000 donation to help the Society of St. Andrews with stability to homeless families as they work toward permanent independence. Home Builders Association of Raleigh-Wake County will renovate the Wake Interfaith Hospitality Network, WIHN, facility in Raleigh. Home to more than 200 children every year, WIHN responds to the needs of homeless families in Wake County. And finally, in the People on the Move section, Dr. Mike Smith of Western Wake Pediatrics was named vice chair of the Wake County Smart Start Board of Directors. Charlotte Clark Turpin was named to the Wake County Smart Start Board of Directors. Jim Green of Stop Hunger Now was named to the Wake County Smart Start Board of Directors. Andrea Woodell Eason, a partner at Blackman and Sloop CPAs, PA, was named to Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Triangle's Board of Directors. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have the page of Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. In her On the Move section, the headline, Raleigh loses Patsy Aiken shop to Wilmington. Popular children's wear designer Patsy Aiken is not ready to stop designing styles for her Chez Ami brand, but she is ready to start slowing down a bit. She and her husband Joel, also a co-owner in the company, will be shutting down the company's warehouse, outlet stores, and offices in Raleigh later this month and moving it all to Wilmington. That's according to a letter recently sent out to their customers, home party salespeople, and fans. Patsy Aiken Designs, which has been in business for 35 years, currently is holding its last ever outlet sale at its Hargrove Road warehouse in Raleigh. The sale ends November 22. Aiken states in the letter that they will be relocating a small division of Patsy Aiken Designs to Wilmington, where she and Joel live now. We are taking the steps forward to spend more time with our family and with each other, she says. We have exciting decisions to make for the future. And another article on this page has the headline, Perimeter 3 coming to Morrisville campus. Make that two big new office buildings under construction at Morrisville's Perimeter Park campus, or more than 450,000 square feet of office space total. With the Teleflex medical announcement on Thursday that the medical device company will be expanding its operations in the Triangle, real estate developer Duke Realty Corporation has wasted no time getting started on construction of the new building that Teleflex will occupy. Teleflex will be taking 130,000 square feet, or about 53% of the space in Duke's new Perimeter 3 office building, confirms Jeff Sheehan, Senior Vice President of Duke Realty's Raleigh Operations. Construction is underway, he says. Steel is going up as we speak. The Perimeter 3 building will be the largest of the three multi-story office buildings anchoring Duke Realty's newest phase of development at Perimeter Park. It will have 245,000 square feet of rentable office space on six floors, he says. That compares to the Perimeter 2 building that also broke ground recently that has 206,409 square feet on five floors of office space. Perimeter 2 is already 94% pre-leased with only 13,223 square feet of office space remaining. It will be anchored by SciQuest of Cary, which will be relocating its headquarters to Perimeter. Perimeter 2 is on track to open in mid-June 2014. Perimeter 3 is scheduled to be completed in September. And the final short article is headlined, Movie Theater to Replace Dillard's at Chapel Hills University Mall. Dillard's department store, an anchor since 1973, has decided not to renew its lease at University Mall and will soon be closing. The mall's ownership group has already found a replacement tenant in movie theater operator Silver Spot Cinema. The 52,500-square-foot Silver Spot Cinema will debut independent and foreign films, as well as blockbusters and 3D films. The theater, expected to open in early 2015, will also feature casual dining and a lounge area. And now we have the page of reporter Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. The first headline, Hospital Stays Decreasing in Length. In the past two decades, discharges from hospitals per 1,000 population have remained essentially unchanged, but total inpatient days per 1,000 population have drastically decreased. This means that on average, the total length of stay per patient has decreased, a factor healthcare economists say can contribute to reducing healthcare spending. According to the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research, which is part of UNC Chapel Hill and compiles extensive data on North Carolina's healthcare industry, the North Carolina acute care days per 1,000 population decreased from 758 in 1990 to 490 in 2011, a 35% reduction. Over the same period, acute care discharges per 1,000 population have fluctuated only from a high of 112 to a low of 102, a 9% reduction. Taken together, these figures show that North Carolinians are going to the hospital at essentially the same rate for the past 20 years, but are staying in the hospital for a far shorter time. Charlotte Williams, who closely follows hospital discharge patterns for the Shepp Center, points to a few contributing factors. Improving technologies and treatments play their role, she notes, a positive sign for all medical researchers. However, keeping costs under control is a driver as well. Reducing length of stay is one way to reduce hospital costs, which is a constant goal of hospitals and health systems, she says. Also, various payers have incentivized hospitals to reduce stays. Medicare, for example, began paying hospitals a fixed cost per diagnosis as opposed to a cost for service basis, which encourages hospitals to treat patients quickly to reduce operational costs. And finally, on this page in the She Said section, the headline is, Clearly, I Was Wrong. Kathleen Sebelius, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary, at a congressional hearing responding to an earlier statement she made telling President Obama that the health insurance marketplaces were ready to go. The exchanges have had problems since they were rolled out on October 1, and only a small percentage of those seeking to buy health insurance on the marketplaces have been able to do so. Sebelius has promised the software glitches will be worked out soon. And now we move to the page of Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. And the main article has the headline, Lenovo's Parker, Here's the Secret to Our Growth. Hours after Lenovo reported record growth for the quarter, the Chinese computer maker's North American head, Jay Parker, breathes a sigh of relief. The company, which runs its Americas division from Morrisville, reported a net profit of $219.7 million for the quarter, up from $162.1 million in the same quarter last year. The Americas grew at over 30%, he says, and over 3 points of market share in that period. So the success here in the Americas, including North America, continues and is really helping the company to the results that we're getting right now. In the United States specifically, he points out that Lenovo achieved double-digit market share for the first time. That's a big milestone for us, he says. While the world knows Lenovo for its PC prowess, the company lapped longtime rival HP as the number one maker of PCs earlier this year. For the second quarter in a row, Lenovo sold more smartphones and tablets than PCs globally. It starts with innovation on the product side, and I think that's been lacking to some degree in the PC industry, he says, pointing to the Yoga PC, a laptop-tablet hybrid device Lenovo launched a year ago. That, in the U.S. consumer market, has been the number one device of its kind. Why? Because it's different from the sea of traditional flat tablets and foldable laptops, and Lenovo's new product, a Yoga tablet, is an expansion of the concept, he says. It's a multi-mode device that can adapt to the way you play or work with it, he explains. It stands, you can hold it in a more comfortable way, it has 18 hours of battery life. These types of innovations, albeit simple, are really driving a lot of buzz in the market and enabling our sales. And now we have a section called All Eyes on Twitter. As a social media titan has its very public debut on New York Stock Exchange, entrepreneurs have the most to learn. Twitter's IPO points the way for startups around the country, including in the Triangle, says Dory Clark, strategy consultant and adjunct professor at Duke University. I asked Clark what Triangle entrepreneurs should pay attention to, particularly those dreaming of IPOs. 1. Temper your expectations. Twitter learned a great deal from how Facebook handled their failed IPO last year. Expectations for Facebook were sky high and almost any result would have been a disappointment. Twitter, on the other hand, went into the IPO process with modest valuation, and consequently, it looks like a big win now that they are able to go public at $26 a share because it shows momentum and strong demand. 2. Think mobile. Twitter shows us clearly that mobile is the future, and any startup needs to have a strong mobile strategy in order to be considered viable moving forward. 3. Growth is everything. The user growth rate is a crucial metric. Twitter's growth rate has been slowing, which is its one potential Achilles heel going into its new launch as a public company. Investors will measure its success based on how it's able to grow its user base, and Triangle companies should pay attention. And 4. Tell a story. All startups are focused on their numbers and their growth, which is critically important, but it's also extremely important to tell a compelling story about your product or service and how it fits into people's lives. Twitter has been able to paint that picture, and investors are responding. And now we have the reporter page for Dawn Curry. Curry covers money and small business. And her first section is labeled Deals of the Week. The headline, Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban invests in Durham company. Executives at Validic, a small Durham-based software company that plays in the healthcare space, says the firm raised $760,000 recently. That's really not the news. What's news is who was involved in this round of the fundraiser. Mark Cuban, the irreverent owner of the Dallas Mavericks professional basketball team, and the regular member of the Shark Tank television show. Validic currently employs about 15 people. Personalized health is the future of healthcare, said Mark Cuban in a statement, and with the explosive growth of new mobile apps and devices coming on the market, Validict solves the fundamental problem of integrating all those new innovations into the healthcare system. I'm very excited for the future of Validict and the mobile health space. Validict, originally founded in Kansas as Motivational Science, moved to Durham in 2011. The company plans to hire 15 additional employees in the next few months. Triangle-based investor David Gardner says he invited Validict to move to the Triangle. One of my conditions for investing was they moved to the Triangle where I could work more directly with them, Gardner said. And the next section is labeled On the Web. Solar panel farm gets boost from PowerSecure. Wake Forest-based PowerSecure, a provider of utility and energy technologies, has completed the installation of an 11,500-panel solar farm on 11 acres at QVC's Rocky Mount Distribution Center. This project supplements an existing system that PowerSecure Solar helped construct in 2008 and brings the total production capacity at the facility to 4 megawatts. And in bold red letters, there's a number, 458,766. The number of gallons PowerSecure says it now conserves in kilowatt hours of energy to reduce CO2 emission based on U.S. EPA greenhouse gas equivalencies at the farm. And our final small article in this section, Google-backed startup opens Raleigh office. A Silicon Valley startup is opening a satellite office in downtown Raleigh. Uber Conference, which was developed by the team that created Google Voice and launched a year and a half ago, is a visual conference calling software that provides traditional audio call but adds a dashboard people can access on laptops or mobile devices so they can see who's on the call or talking. The company is headquartered in San Francisco and has a satellite office in San Jose, California. Raleigh is a thriving, dynamic market with an extraordinary talent pool, said T.R. Missner, general manager of Uber Conference's Raleigh office. And now we turn to the Spotlight article in the Triangle Business Journal. The Spotlight in this edition is on banking. The headline, Brian Moynihan, Captain of the USS Bank of America. And this article is written by Adam O'Neill. Brian Moynihan sees Bank of America Corporation as a large battleship coming out of the harbor and back into open seas, and that could mean throwing even more bank branches overboard to lighten the load. The chief executive of the nation's second-largest bank made the battleship comparison as he opened his company's financial services conference in Manhattan on November 12. Moynihan has led Charlotte-based Bank of America for nearly 4 years, spending most of his time working on repairing the bank's bruised balance sheet, settling legal disputes tied to the housing crisis, and cutting expenses after years of mergers left the bank bloated. We are a huge company, and we are coming out of harbor this time to take this huge battleship to cruising speed, he said, according to a transcript. That means we can now focus more and more on each business. Moynihan gave a broad overview of the company's performance and expectations, including loan demand, consumer behavior, and the changing branch culture. In a Q&A session with a Bank of America Merrill Lynch analyst, he did not comment on the bank's latest string of legal woes, including reports of a pending settlement with Freddie Mac and other feuds with regulators and prosecutors that allege Bank of America is liable for alleged wrongdoing at Countrywide Financial, which Bank of America bought in 2008. Moynihan said 8 million customers still use the bank's branches, but 7% of all checks are now deposited with a smartphone or tablet, even though such mobile deposit services have been offered for only about a year at Bank of America. I have branches, I have ATMs, I have phones, I have online, I have mobile, and all of it has to mix together to work for the customers, he said. And if you think about that optimization question, it's fascinating, really interesting to watch as it's taken place over a few years. A report this week from SNL Financial shows Bank of America is cutting branches at a faster clip than most of its peers, with net closings of 183 bank centers in the past 12 months. Moynihan said the bank has successfully reduced its branch footprint to fewer than 5,400 banking centers from 6,100. He says the bank has committed to cut the network to 5,000, but it could reduce even further as behaviors change, moving to fewer full-service centers and adding express options. I don't know where it goes ultimately, but there will be branches. There will always be all these capabilities because customers want them, he said. You'll see this different format, but the reality is all of them are critically important to us. And I think longer term, because more people are transferring activities to electronics, you'll see the numbers of branches come down. Bank of America is the sixth largest bank in the Triangle, with 33 branches and $2.8 million in deposits locally. And Adam O'Daniel, the reporter on this story, covers banking, entrepreneurs, and technology for the Charlotte Business Journal. And now we have an article in the small business section, an article on Data Staff Incorporated. The headline, Matching Companies with IT Workers is What They Do Best. And this article is written by Dawn Curry with the Dateline of Raleigh. Data Staff CEO Keith Rick started his IT staffing company in 1998 when a similar firm he was working for made staff cuts, leaving him jobless. He hired his first two employees, Glenda Mueller and Rob Craybill, and today they are president and vice president of business development, respectively. The company serves 15 to 20 clients, including local and state government departments, providing IT professional staff for short or long-term projects. To keep its edge, the company seeks out large staffing opportunities and works to build lasting relationships with clients. The hottest IT jobs range from desktop support to project management, and Data Staff assists clients with tech support, systems development, project development, client server development, web development, network support, e-commerce, and software development. Applicants are screened through online testing, reference checks, and on-site interviews. The company's family-friendly culture makes Data Staff an attractive place to work. For example, all employees are treated as if they are full-time, with a complete benefits package including insurance benefits, paid vacation, sick days, holiday pay, and a 401k plan. Last year, Ricks, Mueller, and Craybill sat down with their staff and decided 2013 would be the year of change. As a group, we decided we need to change the infrastructure of our company so we could work smarter, not harder, Rick says. We implemented a new payroll system. We also added a new applicant tracking system, which won an award. The applicant tracking system, which cost the company $40,000 per year, won the ICIMS Excellence Award for Best Company Expansion in the Industry in 2013. The system allows the staff to add notes to applicants for future use, send paperwork to applicants to remain paperless, and offers an e-verify service to help maintain compliance with regulations. The company also expanded its recruiting team and hired 75 people this year. Company leaders recommend networking as the best tool for finding a job. I cannot say enough the importance of meeting new people and staying connected, Mueller says. You never know who may have a position open or know someone who does without staying involved in your community, sports activities, and church. Someone can have all the experience and education they believe they need, but without staying involved and getting connected with others, you can end up a number instead of a face. Mueller says in any given week, the company could be looking at filling anywhere from 25 to 50 open positions, with the team speaking to several candidates. Which brings it to its next challenge, space. In 2000, Data Staff moved into a 1,500-square-foot building with six offices. In 2010, the company moved into a 3,000-square-foot location off Six Forks Road. But the leaders of the company would really like 4,600 square feet to be comfortable. Another challenge, healthcare. Federally mandated healthcare is our biggest challenge, Rick says. It's hard to maintain compliance. The price is the second largest item on our balance sheet. Data Staff has placed many employees into permanent roles with clients, which leaves the leaders feeling like they have contributed to the advancement of their employees' professional career. We want people who have commonality, but we also want everyone to be different, Rick says. We've got guys older than me with white hair, and we've got people as young as 23 working for us. Everyone here depends on everyone. The reason we are successful is because we take the ideas of the young and the experience of the older employees, and we collaborate. And the company bio, the company name, Data Staff Incorporated, CEO, Keith Ricks, headquarters, Raleigh, founded 1998, revenue $16.5 million, employees 212. And now we turn to the viewpoint page, and we will read the editor's notebook and the headline on it, Minimum Wage Debate Conjures Up Memories of Roy Rogers' Job. And this is written by Rebecca Troyer, the managing editor of Triangle Business Journal. After my freshman year at Indiana University, like most college students in the days before resume building internships, volunteer missions, and study abroad, I returned to my hometown to look for a summer job. I was thrilled to land a $2.90 per hour job at the Roy Rogers restaurant on the corner of Dixie Trail and Hillsborough Street in Raleigh. Roy's had been a popular Broughton hangout. Those were simpler times when high school came with such fringe benefits as off-campus lunch, upperclassmen as bus drivers in designated school smoking areas, so I thought working there would be fun. Needless to say, I had a thing or two to learn about the realities of fast food labor. Girls worked the front lines. Our only exposure to actual food preparation was the occasional emergency dash to the fry basket during a lunch rush. On my first day, wearing my red checked shirt, bolo tie, red cowgirl hat, and denim skirt, I learned to say, "Howdy, partner," when customers entered the restaurant, and "Happy trails" when they left. I learned the difference between a regular order of fries and a holster, and the life cycle of the famous fried chicken as it withered from under the hot lamp. Early on, the shift manager took me aside and showed me a section of the employee manual that required denim skirts to be 6 inches above the knee. Mine wasn't quite short enough, he said. Embarrassed, I complied. I needed the job. Over the summer, I learned how hard it was to arrange one's whole life around an unpredictable work schedule imposed by the whim of management. I learned the basics of customer service, such as being nice to the whiny patron who complained her burger was too well done after she'd ordered it branded, partner. I cleaned floors, washed tables, and burnt myself on hot fat. I learned that it is never really possible to get the smell of grease out of one's hair. With a few $100 and a load of life experiences in my pocket, I left Roy and Trigger at summer's end and returned to college, determined to make sure my future employment options included a desk, not a cash register. Unlike 3 decades ago, the majority of today's fast food workers are not teenagers working part-time jobs. Of the approximately 693,000 fast food workers in North Carolina, more than 80% are over age 20, and almost half of those work full-time. Fast food wages are front and center in the current debate over minimum wages, fueled in part by a recent report that more than half of America's fast food workers receive some form of public assistance to supplement their low pay. Because the issues are both economically and politically complex, Congress has historically been slow to implement minimum wage increases. From 1997 to 2007, the rate was stuck at $5.15 per hour. In 2007, Congress approved a phased-in increase, topping out at $7.25 in 2009. Business opposition remains strong, especially among small businesses whose payrolls represent their most costly line items. But there are also outspoken business supporters of increasing the minimum wage, such as companies like Costco that have joined a coalition called Business for a Fair Minimum Wage. Interestingly, while Congress has stalled on the issue, 21 states and the District of Columbia have already raised their minimum wages. A Gallup poll taken earlier this year revealed that 71% of Americans support an increase. In the end, the best solution may be to legislate minimum wages at the state and local levels, as with many other potentially divisive issues. Whether North Carolina legislators have the political will to work through their differences and come up with a workable compromise remains to be seen. And in our last few minutes, we'll read from TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Triangle's October home sales up 17% over last year. Home sales in the Triangle during the month of October improved almost 17% in October compared to the year prior, according to the monthly market activity report released on Tuesday by Triangle Multiple Listing Service. The Triangle residential sales market closed on 2,320 new and existing home properties in October compared to 1,988 sales in October of 2012. The MLS report includes records of the sale of both new and existing homes as reported by local real estate agents to MLS. The region's median sales price is up 6.4% to $200,000, and the average sales price is up 7% to $239,766 compared to the year prior. Bayer Crop Science to open new Bee Center in Clayton. Bayer Crop Science has officially announced a date for the opening of its Clayton Bee Care Facility, situated on 281 acres in Johnston County. The ribbon cutting is scheduled for November 18, and executives, including CEO Jim Blome, will be present for the celebration. Bayer Crop Science, which has its headquarters in Research Triangle Park, hopes its center research will mean new apiary approaches that won't just benefit pollinator health, but the health of the global food supply. Additionally, the site will support scientific research and help educate the public on the honeybee's place in agriculture. Bayer Crop Science is planning to complete its North American Bee Care Center in Research Triangle Park in the spring of 2014. Raleigh ranks number 10 in Digital City Survey. Raleigh has made another top 10 list, ranking in the 10th spot on the 2013 annual survey by Republic's Center for Digital Government and Digital Communities ranking of cities with populations of 250,000 or more. "We have worked hard and strategically to position our city as a digital community," said Chief Information and Community Relations Officer Gail M. Roper in a release. "This underscores the City of Raleigh's dedication to using technology for economic development and enhancing service delivery to Raleigh citizens. City rankings are based on innovations using technology." And finally, ACC Men's Basketball Tournament heads to Washington, D.C. in 2016. The Atlantic Coast Conference announced Wednesday it would hold its 2016 Men's Basketball Tournament at the Verizon Center in Washington, D.C. And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.